This section that we're going through here in Exodus is, it's all about tests. Now, some of you may respond to the word test the way that Maynard Krebs responded to the word work. For those of you who have never watched Dobie Gillis, Maynard, he would hear the word work and panic. You know, someone would say the word and he would repeat it, work, and he would get out of there as quick as he could. And some of you may hear that word test and think, test, you know, that doesn't give you good feelings inside. There are many different kinds of tests, though, right? There are intelligence tests, personality tests, software tests, and then really the tests I think mostly come to mind, the tests you took in school, educational tests. You know. But even there, you have different types of tests at school. You have placement tests. That was one that told you which section of freshman English you were going to be in. And you had aptitudes or achievement tests that you took outside of the classroom. But then in a subject, a teacher might give you a diagnostic test at the very beginning. They're trying to figure out, what does the student know? And what don't they know about this subject? And then, of course, at the end, they have the summative test. They would test how much the student learned. But in the middle, some teachers would give what's called formative tests. So the goal of a formative test or a formative assessment is to see where the student is at in the middle, to see what needs to happen with the instruction, what needs to be talked about more, and really for the student to know how much they might need to focus on a particular subject. So I think that's a good name for the kind of test that the Lord is giving. It's not a formative test in the same sense, but it is forming. It is for the forming of these students. So it's not given in order to form the instruction in the future. It's given to form the student for the future. And so despite the fact that when we hear the word test and hear the Lord testing someone, it doesn't bring good thoughts to mind. These tests are for our good. And we talked about this earlier with chapter 15. You know, these places where it says that God tests someone, that can cause us to be a little bit troubled. I mean, some take offense at a picture that forms in their head when they hear those words, that God tested someone. You know, they might imagine a scientist, you know, testing animals. And even if they don't have a problem with lab rats, they have a problem with God experimenting on humans. And that's kind of what comes to their mind. Or some might picture their relationship with God as though they're equals. And so they basically judge God on the basis of what would actually fit in a human relationship. And so anything that seems untrusting or disingenuous, it seems out of place, testing someone in a relationship. Now, even though this does involve, there's a relational quality to what's happening in these chapters, we need to keep in mind, first of all, that the Lord God is both our creator and our judge. He is not an equal. He determines the curricula. He determines the final assessments. He has reasons why he made us the way that he made us, and he has plans for how we're supposed to live. He's going to give us our final test. He's going to give us that summative assessment at the very end. He's going to determine whether we pass or fail and what the consequences are for that. And so we, his creations, are not his equals, even though God really has condescended to have a relationship with us. And so that's just what this test is really about. This is a relationship between creatures and our Creator. So that's not going to take place the same way that our relationships with other humans take place. If you want to go and get to know another human, you know, there's things you could do. You could spend time with them. You take time to listen to them, to hear about them, interact with them, to learn what they're like, what they don't like. You observe them, they observe you, and you figure out, how do you treat them appropriately? How do you make sure not take advantage of your relationship? Well, you can't do that with the Creator. It's going to be different. And so, in order for us to get to know our Creator, he has to reveal himself to us. If we're going to understand how we relate to him, he's going to have to teach us. So tests are actually one of the ways that God teaches us about our relationship with him. Tests help us to understand how do we relate to him? How do we respond to him in this or that circumstances? So they're not just, when the Bible talks about these tests, they're not just assessments of whether or not a person's going to learn and respond correctly. It's an aspect of them. But these tests are formative. They help us learn. They form us. And so God had redeemed Israel from Egypt, from their slavery, so that they would know him, so that they'd have a relationship with him. And in knowing him, they could serve him instead of serving Pharaoh, instead of serving their sinful desires. And so as Israel's getting to know their God, they needed to learn what that relationship was like. And so the Lord tested them to teach them how to relate to him. If you want to know, if you want to know God in a truly relational sense, you need to be put in situations that force you to learn how to look to him, how to interact with him. So in chapter 16, the Lord provides that very kind of situation. And as verses 4 and 5 show, and we were there last time, we were in Exodus, there are two parts to this test. Exodus 16, 14 and 5, verse 4 and 5 rather, say, "Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So you could say there's two tests here. There is the daily bread test and the Sabbath test. And each is really a formative test. It's training these Israelites. Now, there's a pattern to both of these. So each one starts with instruction, and then the people respond to that instruction, and they seem to pass the test. But then there's some additional instruction, and some of them fail the test. And then there's a response, first from Moses and then from the Lord. And after that, it looks like the people have learned what they're supposed to be doing. And so this morning, we have a chance to learn from their tests. We need to pay attention to this because we also experience a similar situation. We experience tests. So we can learn from what they go through, and then we can learn about the tests that we face, how we can understand and learn about our relationship with our Creator and Redeemer. So let's look at the first test, the daily bread test, found in verses 16 through 21. If you remember, the Israelites, they reached the wilderness of Sin, and they were 1 month out from Egypt. They'd been in Egypt. Now they're a month out of Egypt, and they were hungry. They're running out of their supplies. So they did what hungry people do in a barren place where there is no food in sight. They panicked and they complained. And none of us is above that. I definitely am not above that. So after Moses addressed the problem with their complaining against him, because he wasn't the one actually leading them, he reminded them of that. After that, God first, he deals with their hunger by giving them quail, kind of addresses it immediately. But then he provides manna the next morning. This is bread from heaven, he says. This is miraculous. And God is providing for his people in a way that none of them would expect it, out in this barren place. And so what Moses does now in our passage is he tells them the rules for this bread from heaven. Here's what the Lord wants you to do. And so every head of the house is to gather enough food for the people living in his tent. I mean, I mentioned this last time we were here in chapter 16. That word gather is the same word that gets used later when the poor go into the fields in the promised land. And they gather up what's left behind intentionally by the harvesters to care for them. And so what you have is a picture of really Israel as beggars in a field, in the Lord's field. He's providing for them. They're gleaning this field. They're gathering it. But they're supposed to do that in a certain way, not in an every man for himself kind of way. They aren't supposed to treat this as a desperate rush for food and to get as much as you can. The Lord is promising to provide for them every day. So they need to collect the food in a way that shows that they trust him, that they believe he is going to do that. So each head of the home gathers only as much as he can eat. Now that phrase more woodenly is each to the mouth of his eating. It has to do with portions. Jay Sklar pointed out it in his commentary. This isn't saying as much as someone can possibly eat. This is not an all-you-can-eat buffet. It's not encouraging them with gluttony. Just eat, you know, pile it on, whatever you want. The point is you're to gather as much as a person typically eats in a day. So that's then disqualified by a series of other phrases. How much a person typically ate was measured by an omer a head. An omer is a measurement, like liters or grams. We don't know exactly what it was, but at least one archaeological find would tell us it's about 2 liters. So everybody gets an omer per person, 2 liters per person for the day. You have different sizes of people in a household, right? You got mamas, papas, babies, teenagers. Everybody eats differently. But the basic idea is that if you divided the household up by the number of people in it, that would be what provides for them. Some eating a little bit more, some eating a little bit less, but overall, they're provided for through that amount. They have a healthy amount of food. Now that's this kind of behavior that God is describing here is not normal behavior in a desperate situation. Human nature typically looks out for numero uno and their own family. Now, God is not downplaying the fact that each of these heads of the household, they're responsible just for their family, make sure that their family gets what they need, but the manner they go about it is measured, literally. They measure it out. Make sure that they're only getting the portion that they need. And that was counter to what these people were wired, how they were wired. I mean, these individuals, they were part of an agrarian society. They each had kind of a garden-sized plot of land that they grew their own food. And at harvest time, you gathered as much food in your harvest as you could because you didn't know what was going to happen tomorrow. So your thinking was you get what you can because you don't know about the future. So that trained them, really, to not go out there and just get a measured portion. I mean, they had been satiated with that quail, but remember the situation. This was a desperate, this comes on the heels of a desperate time. They looked like they were going to run out of food. I mean, they were accusing Aaron and Moses of taking them out to the wilderness and killing them by starvation. So that this was a desperate time. So this is very, I mean, imagine the restraint necessary to just get enough for that day. It goes against their nature, but they did it. And I would say that the way that God provides for them in this situation is better than the way that our society often today provides for those who need things. Right? Our version of providing for the poor often has no obligation for any industriousness. Here, the people are, they're not just handed what they need. They have to go out, and even later in Israel, they have to go out and get their food. They have to do something to get their food, and that's a good thing. Even if you, in your job, your work, cannot provide, it's good for you to still do something in order to get your food. So this was a good thing. They were still completely dependent on God, but needed to still do some work. Now, I think it may have helped that the people around them were friends and extended family. They were kinsmen. Regardless of that, though, it's important to address your needs in a way that's considerate of the other people around you. You know, it's important for believers in a local church to do this too, to be attentive to the people around us with our needs. We, in our society, we've been trained not to think that way too. We've been trained to look out for ourselves and to make sure that we put ourselves first. That's encouraged. And so one of the greatest ways to combat that natural tendency is to know that the Lord is going to provide for you, just like he did with Israel. So just like Jesus promised his own disciples in Matthew 6:33. You don't have to focus on your necessities as though that's all there is to life. We seek first following God's rule, living out his righteousness, and we trust him to provide what we need. And so the Apostle Paul taught believers in a similar way to care for the people in their congregations that needed help, especially through the laws on widows. That's the same thing that the early church did in Jerusalem, right? The early chapters of Acts. It talks about how they provided food for those in need. Again, specifically widows. And they also actually provided financially for those displaced people. I mean, all these people had come to Jerusalem for this feast. They had been dramatically changed by this gospel that they're now trusting in Jesus, and they stayed without any other way to provide for themselves. And so the believers there, they sold some land, they provided financially for each other. That's the attitude that these brothers and sisters in Christ had for each other. But that doesn't just stay within a local church. It extends beyond that to our extended family, you could say. And so what Paul does is he quotes verse 18 of Exodus 16 as he's encouraging the believers in Corinth to provide for the relief of the believers in Judea. They were collecting what they had to provide for the people in Judea who, the other believers, the churches there in Judea that were in need. And so in 2 Corinthians 8, he writes to encourage them to use their abundance, what they had above, the excess that they had, to provide for the needs of other believers. And so really, again, this passage, by the way that the people are told to go about getting their food, this passage encourages us to have an awareness of others, to consider if the excess we might have should be provided for our brothers and sisters in need, and to be attentive to that. The goal here, just to be clear, it's not to establish financial equality. So both in 2 Corinthians or in Acts, they're not talking about making sure that there are no financial differences and redistributing the wealth. Instead, it's just teaching you that the Lord gives excess at times so that you can provide for those without, that are lacking. That's the way he's designed it for the church, that we provide for people who need. So the way that God provides very often is one member who has more provides for another member who has less. And that's how we provide for what we need. So after Israel's right response, they do what they're supposed to do, Moses adds some instruction for how to handle this food that they've now gathered. So they gathered it, but then he says in verse 19, let no one leave any of it over till morning. I mean, the impulse to leave something for the next day in this situation makes sense. I mean, again, they've been a month away from home. They've run out of food. If you are traveling in that kind of situation, it makes sense to not eat everything that you collected that day, to save some for later. That's a wise thing in most cases. It's sensible. It ceases to be sensible, though, when the Lord tells you not to do that. And look what happens. Verse 20 says that they didn't listen. Now, who's the they? It's not the people as a whole. It's only some of them. But when one person acted in the nation in the wrong way, it affected the nation as a whole. You see this later in Joshua with Achan, who takes something when he's not supposed to, and it results in the next battle failing and people dying. So the people needed to understand they had a responsibility to one another. This is the same thing that's true in the church. One sin in the church, one glaring, obvious public sin, doesn't stay there. It spreads, it infects. And so there's always an issue when one in the group is doing the wrong thing. It affects the group as a whole, and that's what you see. So it's clear not everyone failed. Verse 20 says, only some left part of it till morning, and it bred worms and stank. Now, it's an important detail to remember because of what's going to happen later. But you can see right off the bat some fail-safes that God established with this test. Even when you fail to obey, to depend on the Lord, it doesn't work. The test is intended to teach, to train. And they can fail, but the same thing's going to happen as a result of that failure. So typical things for humans is if you do something and it doesn't work, well, you don't try it again that way. And so this was something that was teaching them. Now, that doesn't make their disobedience okay. And Moses is incensed by their inability to do just simple instructions. And he's right to be angry. So what is the Lord teaching them as he trains them in this behavior? He's teaching them that he can provide for their daily bread. Before they reach the promised land, when they're going to be doing all the things that they did in Egypt, tilling the land, planting, harvesting, that would make it a little bit harder for them to see that the Lord is the one providing. But that's still the case. I mean, yes, you're providing for yourself in a sense. You know, this is when you're farming, you're showing that you're not lazy. You're not expecting someone else to provide for you. Your work typically has a result every time. But even then, everything we have, and we could move on from farming to just our general way that we provide, everything we have, down to our effort, is from the Lord. So the Creator, he made us, gave us these abilities, he provides for us. We should always look at things the same way, that Israel has the opportunity to see through the way God provided manna, that we are continually, every day, whatever we have is provided by the Lord. And so we look to the Lord every day for our daily needs. And that is what he's teaching them before they get to the promised land, that they depend on him, that life is not simply a matter of procuring bread for yourself. There's more to it. That's exactly what God tells the second wilderness generation when he looks back on their experience and he says, this is what the Lord was doing when he gave you bread. So he says in Deuteronomy 8, verse 3, and he humbled you and let you hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of God. The previous verse there in Deuteronomy mentions that this was a test. This test, again, is formative. It's meant to form in these people the reality that they are dependent on God, that their provision, their daily provision of bread from heaven is provided for them. So that following the Lord's instructions is what is most important, regardless of what they think of those instructions. So we cannot treat life as though it's just a matter of material things. God's in charge. His word is the priority. And that cuts through some of those ethical dilemmas you might hear people say from time to time, you know. Questions like, is it okay to steal if you're starving? Or, you know, the lifeboat question. You're in a lifeboat with four people. You only have enough supplies for three. Who do you throw to the sharks? That kind of question. And the way those questions are proposed is, this is all you're supposed to think about are these parameters. These are the parameters, and so you now have to make an ethical decision. Well, for Christians, that's never the only parameter. You know, there's more to it for a Christian. We cannot ever take a situation and say, this and this means this. Should we disobey in a situation? Because, well, we're starving, therefore. We all have to recognize that there's another factor, that God can provide for us. So whatever ethical dilemmas, and some of them are quite minor, whatever ethical dilemmas you have an opportunity in those moments as a test. Are you going to trust what God has said, or are you going to do your own thing? Seemingly go it alone, and look, these are just ethical things, and we have to figure out what to do in this situation. No, that's not it. God has promised, seek first God's rule and righteousness, and all these things will be added. You can believe that, or you can do your own thing. But that is what we learn in these situations. Now, thankfully, Israel learns from the test. Verse 21 shows what happens on the following day, or following days. They gather what they needed just as they were instructed. It says morning by morning, and it explains why that's necessary, to gather in the morning. Gather in the morning because God had built in a daily reset, a reset. So what happens after the morning? The sun got hotter, and it melted all of that manna away. So they collect what they collected was continued. It was preserved for the day, but everything else would melt away. So they start to get the hang of things, in a sense, and then comes a second test. I'm referring to it as the Sabbath test, starting at verse 22. They figure out how things are working. They're doing what God tells them to do. And the sixth day comes, and something changes. Now, the way verse 22 reads, you could take it in a couple different ways. Some take it as suggesting that the people gathered twice as much unexpectedly. Like they had gone out into the field, done everything that they did as normal, but when they got back, it was twice as much. Others think that, well, back in verses 4 and 5, there were instructions. There was a heads up as to what was happening. And so they suggest that verse 5 was communicated to the people in some way, that they knew on the sixth day they were supposed to gather double, and that's what they did. Now, the question is, what do you do with the fact that the leaders go and tell Moses? So I don't see anything in these verses that suggests surprise, as though they went and gathered it and then were shocked, like, oh, man, we got twice as much. There's no word behold. There's nothing in the text that leads us to that reaction. And I think what's happening with, as I read it, the leaders, they're coming to Moses and reporting what they did. They haven't been given any instructions for this double portion. Just said, on the sixth day, you get a double portion. So now they're coming to Moses, in a sense, saying, now what? We did it. We did the instructions. Now what? And that's when Moses gives instructions for the Sabbath. He tells them the next thing, just when they need to know it. Now the wording, it says, tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. It sounds a little bit more repetitive in Hebrew. The words solemn, or day of solemn rest, and Sabbath in Hebrew, they're Shabbaton and Shabbat. Shabbaton and Shabbat. You could see this similar wording. So they're built on the same root that basically means to cease from doing something. The first is used in a lot of different ways. Shabbaton is used to talk about the Day of Atonement or other days of rest during feast times or even a sabbatical year. But it seems like the reason why Moses uses two words here is because they've never seen this practice before. This is brand new, and this is explanatory for them. I mean, we have every reason to assume that Pharaoh would have never allowed them to have a Sabbath. He's not going to allow them to even leave for a couple days to do something, to worship the Lord. He's not going to say, oh yeah, sure, you guys want to do a Sabbath every seventh day. No problem. And there's no evidence that this occurred in Egypt. There were no Sabbaths in Egypt at the time. So based on the reading of the word itself, we have every reason to assume that this has never been done prior to this. There's nothing about the wording that would be suggestive that it necessarily was we could read between the lines and this was actually happening, maybe with the patriarchs, or maybe Israel was doing this in some way. Everything points to this being a new thing they've never done before. And that's why the leaders come and say, okay, now what? They're not practicing Sabbath. They don't know what to do with the double portion. Now, a lot of translations, instead of saying like cease or stop, they translate this word rest. And certainly rest plays into this idea. I mean, the idea of you cease from work, you do gain that benefit. And God does talk about that benefit. But that's not the primary point in here or later on when the Sabbath's described. The key, I would say, starting in to understand this, the key to understanding the practice begins with the word holy. Holiness has to do with God. God is holy. He alone determines what else can be made holy. And so in chapter 19, the Lord's going to reveal his desire for Israel to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And yes, holiness involves behavior, but we shouldn't rush to that. The first aspect to consider when it says that they're to be a holy nation is that God has set them apart from all the other nations to be his special people, his treasured possession. So the quintessential statement for what that means for Israel is summed up in Leviticus 19:2. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Israel's holiness is a reflection of God's holiness. So the Lord is calling them into something that directly relates to him in saying this is a holy Sabbath. Moses gives some instruction on the sixth day, tells them to prepare their food as usual. They can either bake it into a kind of bread, or they can boil it into maybe some noodles or maybe something like oatmeal. And they can keep that. They prepare the double portion as they normally prepared it, but they only ate the normal amount, and they had some leftovers. And they're to be kept for the following day. Now listen to what happened. Last time, the manna was preserved, that people did what they weren't supposed to do and had some leftovers, and it went bad. But look at what happens here. In verse 24, it says, they obeyed. It says, so they laid it aside till the morning, as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink, and there were no worms in it. I mean, this bread is miraculous. This is not just some normal kind of bread. It does what the Lord wants it to do when he wants it to do it. And it can vary in its practice. So we shouldn't look at this as though, well, there's just some natural properties at work here. This is bread from heaven. For 6 days, you can't preserve it overnight. For one day, you can. So the next day, Moses gives instructions. They've preserved it. Then the next day, he says in verses 25 and 26, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. So now that it's clear why they needed a double portion, there isn't going to be any out in the field to gather. So now they have what they need with the leftovers. But notice the emphasis in the Lord's instructions. Twice he mentions that there won't be any manna out in the field. So once again, this is not a normally occurring phenomenon. One day, 6 days, it's out in the field. One day it's not. It's not just some normative thing that's transpiring, not some natural property. It happens only when the Lord provides it. But the Lord stops providing it on the Sabbath. He ceases his activity, and then he calls Israel to imitate him and cease theirs as well. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Now, later, God gives them more instructions. We'll look at this in Exodus 20, but there's also instructions there in Deuteronomy 5. He gives some reasons for this practice. And in both instances, his reasons are basically, do this because I did this. You imitate me. So in Exodus, he says, imitate me. I ceased from my labor of creation on the seventh day. So you follow suit. You imitate that. And in Deuteronomy, he says, I gave you rest as slaves in Egypt. You do the same thing for your slaves in Sabbath. In both cases, it's imitation. He's saying, you will be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Now, there are a number of ways that God calls Israel to be holy, to imitate his holiness in the old covenant with their instructions. Some of the commands call for Israel simply to really love their neighbor as God has loved them. Some of them are a little bit more symbolic, like their commitment to eat only kosher food, which just so happens to line up with what's only allowed for God's sacrifices. So there's a number of these different ways, and we'll talk about where Sabbath fits in all of this. But for now, the stress is imitating the Lord. That's a major point of our salvation. We are rescued from our sin so that we can be holy. Not rescued from your sin simply so you don't have to go to hell someday. You're rescued so that you can be holy. And from the very beginning of our experience of salvation, we're called to be those holy new creations. The way Paul puts it in Ephesians 4, he says the Christians are called to a new life, to put on the new self created after the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. And in just a few verses after that, he tells believers to be imitators of God. That is what we're saved for. So Sabbath is pointing to something foundational for God's people. That's why it's so central to the Old Covenant. I mean, it's found in the Ten Commandments. It's called, it's referred to as the sign of the covenant. It points to the nature of the relationship. God, through covenant, becomes their God. They become his people. What typifies that relationship is that they imitate his holiness. That's how they act as his people. So this is a very simple requirement to cease from their normal activities as a way to point them to their holy calling. So it's understandable that even though this was new, even though this is something they'd never done before, the Lord gets upset when the people refuse to obey. Because this is no minor refusal. This is really the rejection of what signifies their primary purpose. So when some of the people failed to trust the Lord and went out to gather manna on the Sabbath and found none, the Lord responds with words that express strong emotion. Now, he's not flying off the handle. This isn't the way that humans express emotion, but this is stated in a way to show how wrong this is. The Lord says, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day." I mean, to be fair, this is a very low bar in terms of imitating God. I mean, this is not some complicated instruction to do something. It's simply to not do something. And so it's described as a gift. This is an easy one. And it is beneficial. There is some benefit to rest. When he reiterates the instruction here, he's not confining them to their tents in the sense that they can never leave on that day. The point is, don't go out of your tent to gather the food in the morning. You don't do that. This is an easy one. That's all you have to do. Once again, the people figure it out. Verse 30 says that they ceased from their work on the seventh day. Now, that really was their only option, right? I mean, they're going to repeatedly learn this. When they go out there, there's nothing. So just naturally, they're going to learn. What's the point of going out on the seventh day? I get it. I understand the process now. So this is, again, a fail-safe. And it points to the fact that this test is one that trains. It teaches them. It forms them by this pattern. So again, this is not a test that gives a final determination of the people. They're not facing the Lord as judge in this instance. This is not their final exam. It's given along the way to help them conform to these practices so that they understand their relationship with God. And at this point, God is very gracious with them. He's very patient. I mean, yeah, he expresses his concern, his issue with what they've done, but he doesn't do anything. There's no punishment here. That's not going to be the case. They're going to continue to be stubborn, continue to fail, and after they commit to obey the Lord, after they become his people through that covenant, on the other side of that, they get treated differently. So the similar things happen in the book of Numbers. As they're leaving Sinai to go to the promised land, but the gloves come off. They have an opportunity prior to that to learn, but then there is a requirement. There are consequences for their failure. And reality is we have a certain amount of time with God's tests. God gives us opportunities now to demonstrate whether we'll listen to him or not. But it's not an indefinite amount of time. The time of testing comes to an end. And then we face God as our judge. So you should never, never presume on God's kindness. Because God is kind and patient with you so that you'll repent. That's what Romans 2:4 says. We're sinners. So our response to these opportunities is going to be to sin. That is what we're supposed to learn. That's what we're supposed to see, that we have a problem. And we need to turn from it and look to God. So you see these other tests in the Bible. Not all of them are failures. I mean, Abraham demonstrates faith with his test. He's a good example, and God uses him to show something different. But at these major turning points, you see really what is true of humanity as a whole. In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve have a test. They fail. Here, in the wilderness, they're given a test to learn that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of God. They fail that test. And just so we're clear, the people that we're talking about right now, they die in the wilderness. They don't pass the test. But there is someone who did pass the test, who never sinned. And Matthew presents Jesus in this way of recapitulating Israel's experience. So just like Israel, Jesus is called out of Egypt. Just like Israel, he passes through the waters in his baptism. And just like Israel, he goes out in the wilderness to be tempted. To be tested, we could say. Only when Jesus is out in the wilderness, I mean, he's been fasting. He has not eaten for 40 days and 40 nights, and that's miraculous. But he's hungry in the wilderness. Does that sound familiar? In that context, where he's tempted to make his own miraculous bread, he says no. He entrusts himself to his Father and dismisses Satan's temptation by quoting Deuteronomy 8, which is about our passage. Jesus said, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God." Jesus knew that living depends on listening to God. He did what we continually fail to do. And he did it so that he could provide us with eternal life. We couldn't do it. He did that for everyone who turns from their sin and rests in him and in his salvation. So Jesus came to do what we could not do for ourselves. We could not rescue ourselves from our sin. He did that by his obedience, by his death, by his resurrection, rescuing us from our sin in our sinful state so that we could become what we were created to become, to be. So turn from following what you think is best. It makes sense. We are rational, intelligent beings. It makes sense to just do what you think is right. Turn from that. We are all sinners. Look to the one who passed all the tests. Look to the one who brings us back to God. And if you are looking to him, realize that we're not through with difficulties. Any preacher who tells you that you should be looking for blessings now is a liar or worse. Don't listen. Believers have to continue in this circumstance, in these opportunities where we're going to be able to show that we're trusting God. So we turn from following what we want to follow the Lord's instructions, and our goal is to listen to him because he saved us, not in order to be saved. We keep going through difficulties that the Lord brings our way. That's our path because it was his path. And so Paul, he encouraged believers in the churches that he planted on his missionary journey in Acts 14:22. He says that he was encouraging them to continue in the faith and saying that through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom. We continue in the faith by continuing to listen to Jesus as we go through those tribulations. So when you're faced with a dilemma, trust the Lord's instruction. It may seem counterintuitive. It doesn't matter. It may seem like our circumstances require us to disobey. It doesn't. So keep going. Keep following your Lord. By his Spirit, you can pass the tests, but only because he did it first for you. Join me in prayer. Father, thank you for the gift of rest in Jesus, for giving us what we could not provide for ourselves. We thank you for providing us with the true bread from heaven that gives eternal life to all who turn from living for themselves and looks to Jesus as the one who died for them, who rescues them from their sin, and then lives for him. Pray that that would be true of everyone here. Everyone would hear that truth, that you would, by your Spirit, cause them to pay attention to it, to not let it pass, to not think, well, I'll deal with that someday, but I'm not ready. That they would realize that they don't know how much time they have, and that it matters now how they respond. By your Spirit, you would enable them. Enable them to hear it and to respond to it. And that we would learn together how to follow you, how to relate to you, to trust you in our circumstances, to know that we can pray to you for daily bread and rest in your provision. Not worry about tomorrow, but to rest in your daily provision and to look to you always. No matter what happens, to know that you will provide what we need, whatever that means. You would grant us faith that believes that and acts appropriately. And then pray that you would give us the kind of grace to see this privilege we have in imitating your holiness. And that that's not something that we should begrudge, that there is joy, great joy, in being holy as you are holy. We ask for your Spirit to cause in us to want to do that and to be able to do it for your glory. Amen.